This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. UNC Charlotte's Dr. James Tabor has spent much of his career combining his work investigating the origins of Christianity and ancient Judaism as a religious studies professor with that of archaeology. His work in the Holy Land has been the subject of numerous books and professional papers and has resulted in some notable discoveries. Those discoveries were made possible in part because UNC Charlotte is the only foreign university in the world with a license to conduct archaeological excavations in ancient Jerusalem. Many of those digs are conducted in the summer, and 22 UNC Charlotte students have just returned from an exhibition, or excavation rather, mere yards from the alleged site of the Last Supper. And they've returned with some news that we'll get to in the course of the program. We welcome Dr. James Tabor back to Charlotte Talks. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mike.
You really just returned. You're all tan.
Thank you.
And we're also joined in our Spirit Square studio by two of the students who took part in this most recent excavation. Kevin Caldwell is a rising junior at UNC Charlotte, a Levine scholar and religious studies student. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. And Caroline Brewer is a rising senior Levine scholar and a nursing student, interestingly enough. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you.
How is it that UNC Charlotte is the only university, foreign university in the world with a license to conduct archaeological excavations in Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem today, all the archaeology has been being done by the Israel Antiquities Authority mm-hmm. and by Hebrew University and other Israeli universities. But we started our site back in the year 2005, and so we're grandfathered in until we finish the site and the whole area of Mount Zion. Now, there's once you've started a site, you get to complete it. And so we dug there from 2005 to 2009. And then we took a break to do processing of finds and post-excavation work, and we returned in force this summer with 60 participants, mm-hmm. 22 from UNC Charlotte. And so we can finish up that project, and therefore we're the only foreign university digging in Jerusalem.
But why not Oxford? Why not Yale? Why not Harvard or some other? Because it's been around for a long time, Jerusalem.
That's so right.
Why aren't they grandfathered in?
I think the attitude of the Israelis is: look, we have major universities. You know, 5-10 major universities. We all have PhDs offered in archaeology. Why should we have foreign institutions doing our work? And so. Both the Israel Antiquities Authority does rescue archaeology, mm-hmm. and Hebrew University and other university, Tel Aviv and others, do digs throughout the city, and UNC Charlotte. So when you drive through the city, you see the different digs that are going on. There's about five of them now. And all of a sudden, from your bus or car or walking, you see our beautiful green sign that you can see on the website, UNC Charlotte. And it's an announcement. It's probably the cheapest advertising we could have. There are 4 million tourists who come to Jerusalem every year, and every one of them goes down the road where our site is because it's the way to the Tomb of David and the Room of the Last Supper. Mm. So you have to pass our site, right. And there's our sign announcing not only our university but our city. Because we are an urban campus.
You have that 49er mascot up there with his pickaxe?
We haven't put that yet. We've joked about it. When we toured on the bus, I took the students on tours on our days off. We dig 5 days, have 2 days off. Someone brought a sponge, you know, size pickaxe and put it in the window of the bus. So that's about as close as we got to the mascot, but... We'll have to talk to the chancellor and see if he would like us to do that or not.
Now, you've been there a number of times, repeatedly, actually, over the course of the last several years on these excavations, but you're not an archaeologist. You are a religious studies professor working, as I said, in the area of ancient Judaism and the origins of Christianity. How involved do you actually become in getting your hands dirty and getting down in the dirt and digging and brushing and all the things that archaeologists do?
Well, I'm trained as a historian of religions, as you said, and about 20 years ago, after coming to UNC Charlotte, I began to realize that unless I combine the material evidence, actually get on the ground and get into the ground, with reading texts, you're only getting half of the story. And so I get very involved in it. Now, as I get older, I have to admit, I'm 67 years old now, there's less I can do physically in terms of just swinging the old pickaxes and carrying the buckets and so forth. But in terms of being a co-director of the dig and keeping up with what's going on, helping to make the decisions, I'm fully a part of it and represent our university. I should mention, I work with Dr. Shimon Gibson, who's an adjunct professor at UNC Charlotte. He's an Israeli and British citizen. He lives in Jerusalem, and he is our partner, and he's the archaeologist, and it's through him partnering with UNC Charlotte that we're able to get the license.
Now I want to talk to these two young people who just got back from this dig, and I'm assuming this is the first one the two of you have ever participated
in. The second dig for me.
Okay.
This is my first.
But you're not archaeology students. So you're a nursing student, and you are a religious studies student, Kevin, and you said that your exposure to archaeology was accidental.
Yes. So I heard about this dig that was coming up as an opportunity and planned to go, and was also planning an entire summer in Israel. Well, lo and behold, I ended up enrolling in another expedition immediately prior to Zion. Lo and behold, I enrolled to stay for 4 weeks at the Mount Zion expedition. And lo and behold, I ended up staying for two to do post-excavation with Mount Zion. So it ended up where 2 weeks turned into 10, and I decided to spend my entire summer in Israel. And it was quite accidental, but it's been a good decision, I would say.
And you're a nursing student.
Yes,
I'm just curious how and why a nursing student gets involved in all of this.
Well, Dr. Tabor presented the dig to the Levine Scholars Program as a whole and offered for us to participate if we'd like and go with the group Charlotte students. And when he presented the idea, it was very interesting to me because even though I'm not an archaeology student, I've always wanted to go to Jerusalem and spend time there. And I figured, what better way than to go and dig in the dirt and really get into it?
Now, we're going to talk about what you actually have to do and the conditions that you do it under, but was it worth it?
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of physical labor.
It was a lot of physical labor, but it was absolutely worth it.
Okay. Is this something that you think has helped you as a religious studies student either be more informed, get into your studies more? Has it provided a new layer I don't even know how to ask the question, a new layer of information that aids you in what you do as a religious studies student?
Entirely. Let me give you a quick analogy. So if scholarship is a building, it's good to have a foundation, right? It's good to sink your concrete into the soil and make sure that you're building your scholarship is firm, is not going anywhere. Well, in my opinion, unless you investigate these material artifacts, your entire scholarship is a collection of things that you've read, theories that you've encountered, different scholars' opinions, and so your entire scholarship is not necessarily your own. But when you go here and you study the material remains and you actually embed yourself in these material artifacts that shape what you study, you sink a foundation in. You begin to develop your own opinions about what you're encountering. You're for the first time, you're the source. Your interpretation is first, and that's something as a student in the humanities, as a student of religion, is very rare.
So this is primary research.
This is primary research, and it helps to contextualize what it is that I study. It helps to give me a background, a material focus to prove that the ideas and the people that I study actually were real. They were here and they did this, this, and this. And I've investigated that. And in excavating their homes, excavating their possessions, you develop something of a relationship with them. It's almost this metaphysical journey where you connect with them and you realize that they were people as well, just as you are a person. And so the goal is to understand one another. Instead of you espousing ideas about what their life was like, it becomes almost a conversation where they're speaking to you through the remains that they've left behind, and you're charged with interpreting them to bring about greater light and to illuminate what it was that they did. So in that sense, yes, it's been the best decision that I ever could have made with my academic career. Mm. And to contextualize so early on is going to benefit me in the years to come.
Now, your interest in this comes from a personal interest, Caroline, and that is you have a personal interest in religion, and that's, I assume, why you wanted to go to Jerusalem.
Yes.
All this time. Do you agree with Kevin here?
Absolutely. It makes all the Bible stories you hear growing up and all the things that you're taught in Sunday school really come to life mm-hmm. when you're walking on the grounds where these things happened and seeing the places that you hear about growing up. It makes it very real.
Just before we started, Dr. Tabor was making a little joke about a common question that he gets from people, and that is, when you're over there, are you touching things that Jesus might have touched? Well, you may be.
Possibly.
I mean, that's got to be, for somebody interested in this, that's got to be something you think about.
It is. It's very touching. It's very gives you kind of a heaviness as you walk through the city and as you're digging in the dirt and finding things.
Because as I said, this Mount Zion project, which is where you were, is what?
Right.
Yards away from where the Last Supper is alleged to have occurred.
On the days off in Jerusalem when I took the students around, since I teach Christian origins, I emphasize the time of Jesus. And because our site, as we'll get to, is now getting down to what we call the Herodian period, the time of Jesus, we emphasize that. So as I was touring them that day, you remember, through Jerusalem, Caroline, I showed them several places that had now been uncovered that you couldn't have touched 20 years ago. You can stand on some steps or walk on a pavement that clearly is from the first century, from that time. So there's no question that Jesus was there. Mm-hmm. Now, what you learn from that is just he's a real person and he existed and he was there, as were hundreds of thousands of other people. But I think it's that emotional connection that you referred to. You said a
Absolutely.
Heaviness. I remember at the Pool of Siloam, this is recently discovered, and it's mentioned in the New Testament, in the Gospel of John, and we found it. Not we, UNC Charlotte, but archaeologists have found it. Remember we sat on the steps for a while, and I could tell there was a mood of, this is not just a tour stop.
Right.
This is where something happened, and let's just sit here a while. And we didn't break into Kumbaya or anything like that, but there was a feeling. And I think whatever your religion is, it's that connection with the past. You know, if you found in a trunk your great-grandmother's letters to your great-grandfather, you know,
right.
you have this feeling
yes. You're connected.
About them.
There's a connection.
In the same way, I have a picture of Caroline when she found her first coin. And the look on her face, it is not a posed picture. We'll put it up later on the website. It's not up there now. And it's fabulous. But wouldn't you say, Carol, it's that feeling, it was a widow's mite mm-hmm. from the time of Jesus, and that's that famous coin that Jesus talks about, the poor widow who only gave the two mites. Now, obviously, this is not the widow's mite
right.
of the story, but mm-hmm. the story is to illustrate a point. And here she is holding in her hand the little teeny widow's mite that you'd read about all your life since Sunday school.
Yes,
now, to me, you learn, but you also are connected.
Well, plus the fact, how many widow's mites could have been in circulation back then? And there weren't that many people. I mean, there were thousands, but there weren't that. When you think of the world today, yeah. it wasn't like that. So she could have touched it. I mean, it could have been the one.
It could have.
Or it could have passed through her hands at some point in her life.
Well, actually, especially since we're digging a wealthy priest's house where all that money went.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of that.
This is the intersection of history. It's also, as that area of the world continues to be today, the intersection of three major religions of the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And that's what makes this particular site, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, interesting, because you've been digging here since 1978. Mm-hmm. You took your first group of students there in 1978. And as you say, you're getting down to the time of Herod. When we come back from the break, I want to talk about what you've found as you go through the layers of where you are digging today. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Founders Federal Credit Union, an innovative credit union with 24 offices across the Carolinas and over 90 ATMs in its network. Information available at foundersfcu.com. Charlotte's Levine Children's Hospital has become a place where notable research in pediatric cancer is being conducted. They are poised to make considerable gains in the next few years despite a lack of funding. You know that children's cancer research gets far less money than research for adult cancers. And we're going to find out how and why this resurgence, or not even resurgence, this burgeoning cancer research program is going on at the Levine Children's Hospital and what it means for children with cancer tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, assisted living communities, unlike nursing homes, are not subject to federal regulations. The history of the industry and new questions about care these facilities provide.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a recent dig, that it's an ongoing dig in the Holy Land in Jerusalem at a site that is presided over by UNC Charlotte, the only foreign university allowed to dig in Jerusalem. Dr. James Tabor is with us, the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte, a frequent visitor to that part of the world and to that dig site, the author of The Jesus Dynasty, The Jesus Discovery, and Paul and Jesus, three books that we've talked about on this show. Kevin Caldwell is a rising junior. Caroline Brewer is a rising senior. At both Levine Scholars at UNC Charlotte both participated in this recent dig this summer. As I said before the break, this site started in 1978. You weren't there in 1978.
Exactly, yeah. UNC Charlotte got involved in the year 2000.
Okay.
But and really 2005 with a group of students going. But the dig goes back to 78 when another archaeologist who's now retired left it abandoned. And then Shimon Gibson, our partner, was a young man then who was working at the site. He turned it over to him, and that's how we got involved in it. We then were brought in as the sponsor.
And that's when they started digging through the modern dirt. And since then, you have gone and found artifacts from, obviously, the modern period, through the Ottoman, Islamic, the Crusades, the Byzantine period, Romans, and the ancient Israelite times.
Yeah, this site is just amazing. When you go there, it's outside the old wall of Jerusalem today. So it's a little bit disorienting because you think, what are they doing? You know, they should go inside the city and dig. But in the time of Jesus, we're at the center city. It would be like First Ward. In other words, if you're in First Ward and you can see the Bank America Tower from your condo window, this would be like the right where we're digging in the time of Jesus, at least, what we call the Herodian period. You could see the temple. This is an aristocratic area, but it goes all the way back to the Iron Age. And so because of the slope of the hill and because of the fill that covered our site over the centuries, it's been well preserved. We have significant remains from all of these periods. So for Muslims, for example, we have a gate, a threshold that we've discovered on our site. We think we can reconstruct now the gate in the future for people that might go back even to the time of Saladin. And when you say Saladin in terms of Muslim history, you know, that's getting very close to for Christians to talk about Jesus or Jews to talk about Moses. And so we have significant Islamic remains. We have a Byzantine building that we've now begun to uncover with a mosaic floor that we think might even be located on the oldest map of Jerusalem. It's a mosaic map in Jordan called the Madaba map. And we think, we haven't established it yet, that it might have a relatively well-preserved remains of a building. So that covers some of the Christian. But for most of my students and many of us, I think, who are interested in the site, it's the time of Jesus, the Herodian period. And we have significant remains from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70, and that's very exciting.
You, this is the Mount Zion Gate site. It's the site of the house of Caiaphas?
That's right. In the time of Jesus, Caiaphas's house has been located. It's up on the hill just a few hundred yards from our site. We're a little bit down the hill. We know that the area we've uncovered now from the time of Jesus or the first century, early Roman, we call it, technically speaking, the Herodian period, we know that this is a wealthy home, it's an aristocratic area, and we're in the basement now of a very wealthy home, probably connected to the priestly classes of Jerusalem, maybe connected to Caiaphas himself. What you have to realize historically, Caiaphas is the son-in-law of Annas. Annas is the godfather. Annas had seven sons who were high priests, starting from before Jesus all the way down to the destruction of the temple in 70. And so he ran the show for about 50, 60 years, putting his sons in one after another, and finally a son-in-law, Caiaphas, who became famous because he presided over the trial of Jesus. Mm-hmm. My guess would be that we're in one of the homes of that extended priestly family. It's a clan. I don't want to say a mafia.
Will you ever know?
I think it's very possible we will know, because what you always hope for in an excavation are inscriptional materials, and that's what we found in other digs. So far, we haven't found any names, mm-hmm. but I think that's ahead.
Is it better to be digging in at the site of a wealthy person or a priest's family's house because they had influence, or would you be just as happy digging at the house of a peasant, so to speak?
I think in archaeology, if we could dig anywhere in Jerusalem, we would be happy with it. Mm-hmm. If we could connect it to the periods that we're interested in, particularly the time of Jesus, since I study early Christianity. But the reason this area is particularly important to us is to understand more about the people who opposed Jesus and what their lifestyle was like. The rich and famous, we would probably call them, the people who ran the show, mm-hmm. who really were in collaboration with the Romans and got along very well with Pontius Pilate and with Herod, whose palace, by the way, is just up the hill. In fact, we parked our cars in a parking lot built over Herod's palace every morning and then walked down to our site. So it's just chilling to think about even the territory we're covering all the time. Hmm. But I think the wealthy home is very fascinating to us, because we'll be able to tell more about that lifestyle and how people lived and what things were like in that time.
Explain to me how the Last Supper might have taken place in an area not terribly far from the house of a person who would not be in league, so to speak, with Jesus, Caiaphas.
Yeah, up on top of the hill where the presumed site of the Last Supper is, millions of tourists go there. It was in the first century a private dwelling. Mm-hmm. And if you read in the Gospels, you'll remember it's not something Jesus owns, but he has some kind of influential connection in this wealthy area of the city. And someone is providing him and his disciples this safe place. I would call it a safe place to meet. And that's how the story reads. Go into the city, knock on this door, tell the person that answers the teacher needs his room. It's all been prearranged. Mm-hmm. That later became, we think, a church, a kind of house church. It's called the Church of the Apostles in the early literature, and was thus preserved. And so that would be the connection Jesus had. He would be, remember, Joseph of Arimathea takes charge of the burial of Jesus. He's wealthy.
Right.
Nicodemus is also involved. He's a wealthy member of what's called the Sanhedrin. So Jesus had influential friends on both sides of the aisle, you might say. And apparently some favored him and some opposed him. And maybe we'll learn more about the people that lived in the area we're digging. And I've referred to the house we're digging. It can be houses, because as we get into what we found, I'm sort of building the suspense
here. I know you are.
It's not necessarily just one house. We're uncovering a significant area of first century Jerusalem in the time of Jesus.
Now, you've described this, Kevin, as a vacation that you go on to do manual labor. And it's not for the faint of heart. It is meticulous. It is dirty. It is hot. How would you describe what the two of you, and you can jump in here too, Caroline, how would you describe what the two of you did?
It's exactly like Indiana Jones.
Including the boulder.
Yeah, including the boulder.
And the snakes.
We all walked around with bullwhips. I'm just kidding. I wish. I actually watched Indiana Jones last night trying to build up suspense for the... Anyways, no, the dig is... There's something about a collection of people that decide to spend their summer doing manual labor in the sun. And what this environment is like is... It's an immersion where relationships and connections form quickly, in the sense that you're working so diligently with people, you're bonding with them in really strenuous physical conditions, that a community builds and a community forms. It's a community that's bent on trying to get something, on trying to uncover something from their collective past, as well as to uncover something about themselves. And what happens is... Everyone contributes to that. Everyone has these grand ambitions, these grand hopes for self-discovery, for contributing to an academic understanding, for contributing to world history, so to speak. And a community forms, and a community sustains itself. They share cups of tea together. They work in the sun together. They help bring buckets and help ferry those back and forth to our dump site.
You make it sound much prettier than it actually is. There's a lot of hauling dirt.
Let me hear your opinion. And what happens, I know that you we're going to talk about this cistern that you found, and you had to take away 2,500
buckets
of dirt. Do you have to sift through the dirt that you haul away?
We did. I worked in a sifting station in one section of the dig, and they just bring buckets of dirt after buckets of dirt, and we just dump them in our sifters and go through every piece of gravel until something didn't look like a piece of gravel anymore, and we'd pick it up and run it over to see
what it was. You worry that you're, because you're not a professional archaeologist, that you're going to miss something important?
Absolutely, until Dr. Gibson comes running, yelling at us to go faster because we're not getting it done fast enough. So then we quit worrying and just go faster.
You would be surprised how quickly you pick this stuff up, though. The more you look at these materials, the more you look at dirt, the more you look at stones, the more you learn about what that is, and the more you can recognize when something is irregular.
So, what would be significant? What would stop you and say, "Okay, that's something I need to take out of the
anything sifter. That looks worked, anything that doesn't look like it's in a natural state." So, for example, stones are very irregular; they're very coarse. They have many edges and many different indentations and points. Well, if you find something that's smooth or looks like it's been shaped, looks like someone has taken a knife or a chisel to it, you begin to stop and you begin to say, "Wait a second, this is uniform. It looks similar. It's symmetrical." Things like that, you begin to stop and you begin to point out, well, this may actually be something. If you're looking at the side of an excavation, the side of a pit, you see a line of stones. Well, that was likely not natural. So you begin to pay attention to the way that stones and walls and dirt line atop one another. We call this stratigraphy in the field. You begin to read a site. You begin to learn the language of archaeology. And you can only do that through experience. You can only do that the more you participate. And I think that's what makes it grounding.
I'm actually amazed that you counted the buckets of dirt that you took out of the cistern.
And that was actually mud. So
mud.
Now, Carolyn's looking for glass, coins, beads, jewelry, hairpins, I think you found.
Mm-hmm.
Really any artifact, and particularly ceramics, tons and tons.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of pieces of
I know
of
you
pottery.
Have to leave the stuff there. Was there ever any temptation to put it in your pocket?
Of course, but we know we had to leave it there, so it just went right over to the main little office area whenever we found something and everyone would celebrate.
And we haven't found that cache of gold coins yet that often... You do find, because getting to the cistern, if you want to go there, the cistern is located in the basement of this wealthy house. So the people are wealthy enough to have a cistern. Kevin worked in the cistern. How deep would you say it is? Is it 30 feet in feet at least?
In feet, it goes down 5 meters. So yes, about.
So you imagine going, and there's a picture on the website of the ladder going down.
And how big around, or how big?
It's about 15 feet wide, maybe 20 feet in length, and it's shaped like an oval. When you're actually down in the cistern, at the very bottom where we finished excavating, it's about 10 feet tall to the ceiling, and then you have to clamber a ladder out.
Now, this would not have been uncommon in the day. This is how they preserved water.
To have one this large and this nice in your own private home says a lot about the wealth of the family. It gives them a water source for and it's
how did the water get in?
It's drained in pipes from the roof and so forth. The whole system was set up. That's no longer there.
Right.
But this cistern was empty of water. It's full of soil and mud.
And so it's still getting water if there's mud in there, right?
Well, it's been covered now for 2,000 years. See, we uncovered the cistern.
Okay.
And, yeah, there's a bit of water in it and mud. But what we really wanted to find out is what had been found in adjacent sites in the Old City. That if you're in the 70 AD period, that's when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, were people living and cooking in the cistern? Because what that indicates is the famine that Josephus, the historian, tells us, this macabre account of how bad it got towards the last. And we have some evidence in our cistern. You can tell, cooking pots, mm-hmm. charcoal fire. You actually dug it with your own hands. So.
Yes, it was a very chilling filling. You descend down into the abyss. You're underground. There's a tiny shaft of light. You're wearing headlamps. It's very humid. And you're pulling things from the ground that you know people used in their last days of life. Josephus Flavius, the historian, indicates that people lived in the cisterns before the Romans completely destroyed the city. So you imagine almost the fear that they would have felt as they've climbed down here. They're cooking. There's charcoal. You see burn marks.
But how would they – wouldn't there have been water in those cisterns back then? How would they have done that?
You could have kept it. We found much evidence. We found – multiple fragments of storage jars, so it's likely that they would have stored things such as water in storage jars. They would have stored grains. They would have stored meat. We found large sections of cattle bone down there, so it's likely that they would have salted that and kept it down there in their last days. We found several intact fragments of cooking pots as well as, again, storage jars.
And see, the Jerusalem was destroyed in August of 70, so by the summer, we were digging in, you know, June, July. By the summer, there's been no rain since February in Israel. You know, the general patterns have stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so that cistern would get pretty dry, and they might have even drained it out and began using it as a hiding place.
So would these have been the people who owned the home that used to sit above it, or would these just be vagrants who came in and used it as a hiding place?
It's hard to tell. The pots are nicely mm-hmm. done, and they see it. My guess, this is just a guess, and a lot of archaeology we finally have to guess about interpreting evidence, but I would guess it's the residents that are actually living there. They have access to the basement and probably are wanting to hide the food that they do have
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of starvation, and there are a lot of gangs running around the city. Breaking in and beating people up and so forth.
It's the apocalypse.
It was the end of that world for sure. It really was.
And this is in the basement of this so-called mansion, I guess, this rich person's house. You call it the Second Temple period.
That's right.
And you also found some other things, some evidence. The reason you know that this is a rich person's house, we're going to talk about some of the evidence that you found, including this is going to be the envy of people who live in Ballantyne. Three ovens.
They have two.
Yeah. I guess if you count the microwave, there are three.
See, we're just down in the basement. We've got triple ovens, and we've got a mikveh. This is a ritual bath. Our Jewish listeners will know what a mikveh is, but Christians call it baptism, but the ritual bath. And then we'll tell you what else we found.
Okay, we'll do that when we come back from the break. Dr. James Tabor's with us from UNC Charlotte, the professor of religious studies there. Also with us, Kevin Caldwell and Caroline Brewer, both students who were on the dig this summer in Jerusalem. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Group Benefit Solutions, providing clarity to Carolina companies uncertain about healthcare reform. Details available at gbs-benefits.com. Unlike nursing homes, assisted living communities are not subject to federal regulations. Diane Rehm and her guests explore the history of the industry and new questions about the care these facilities provide. That's coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. Some of the sites that we're talking about, you can see there are photos we've posted on our website of our guest's excavation in Jerusalem. You can go to wfae.org/charlottetalks for information about that. And you can also find the websites that Dr. Tabor has or will mention as we go through this conversation. We'll post them on our website as well. We're coming right back.
Last year, a white supremacist opened fire inside a Sikh temple near Milwaukee. The massacre led the Sikh community to search for answers, and for some Sikhs, to embrace their identity.
No matter how different anybody looks, we're just as much of a human being. And in America, we're just as American as anyone else.
A Sikh community recovers today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fact that UNC Charlotte has the only permission of any foreign university outside of Israel to dig in Jerusalem. Dr. James Tabor has been on these digs for years, has written several books about some of the discoveries that they have made in the course of digging in Jerusalem. He's with us today to talk about the Mount Zion dig that's going on now, and along with Kevin Caldwell and Caroline Brewer, who are two students, Levine scholars, who were at the dig this summer and participated in it. We were talking about this second century mansion that you're digging in here, the basement of which has, you found three ovens in the kitchen and also a mikvah. And is that the big discovery, the mikvah, the fact that you found this ritual bath?
Actually, first century. You said second century.
Okay, I'm sorry.
First century.
Second temple.
The ritual bath is a big discovery because for a family to have a ritual bath is just seven steps leading down to a pool, mm-hmm. kind of like steps to nowhere. It's just to go down and dip yourself. It's not to wash in. It's to practice the rites of ritual purification. So the big discovery was next to the ritual bath, and we had no idea. This is under meters of fill. Mm-hmm. It was only found the last day of the third week. And the top of a little doorway began to appear. You're thinking, hidden chamber, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is very exciting. What's behind the door? And we decided just to wait until the next week, try to not even think about it over the weekend because we were very excited not to mention it, and just come back the final week. And Kevin was there. Caroline had already gone back. But we began to just work furiously to clean this room out. And it is this beautiful plastered bath, meaning tub, a bath to cleanse yourself in, not toilet, but bath, mm-hmm. right next to the mikveh. So what does this mean? This means that instead of going to just a public mikveh, as the poor would have to do, not only did this person have their own private ritual pool for immersion, probably a priestly family that would use this on many ritual occasions, going to the temple and so forth, but it's a sign of special privilege and wealth for a Jewish woman or man to also be able to bathe, like in Greco-Roman style. The tub is unbelievable. Any of us would be glad to have it in our homes today.
Really?
It's plastered and beautiful. And it's in a fairly good state of preservation. And so the bath, I take, it is our big news. The big news is the bath. But it's what the bath really means. What the bath means is that we have significant areas of well-preserved material where we are, as the bath is just the beginning. We're going to next year go back, and the year after, the Israel Antiquities Authority came out about that third week, mm-hmm. and they saw what we were beginning to uncover, and they said, you were talking about 3 years. This is a minimum five. What you've got, we've had nowhere else in Jerusalem. And so just in terms of the preservation of the remains. And the reason it happens is very interesting. In the 5th century, the Emperor Justinian built the Nea Church, a huge basilica right north of our site, just north of our site. He pushed all of his fill for the foundations of that church down over our site. We've spent 5 years removing that fill bucket by bucket. But what that fill did is preserve the remains of the first century. So that's very exciting to us.
Wow. You know, you have, because you've been on this program many times, and we've talked about some of the other things that you've discovered over the years, and they seem to be relatively significant. Are you just lucky, or is that because of where you're allowed to dig, that you just happen to have access to treasure trove locations?
I'm going to blame it on Shimon Gibson partly, because remember, he's the one who called me about the John the Baptist cave, mm-hmm. and he was just... I guess he says, "I can't help it if I'm lucky," to quote Bob Dylan. You know, he just was surveying the area of Suba and saw these images in the cave, and we spent 10 years digging that cave, and it turned out to be very significant. He's also the one that was called in on the Talpiot tomb, if you remember. And so in some ways, Gibson has been my link to these three sites, and I thank him for it.
Yeah.
And so maybe he's the lucky one. But I've, in each case, been grateful to be able to follow up on what we have discovered.
Knowing what you know about, maybe you don't know much because we're just now uncovering it, but knowing what you know about construction in that period and what rich folks' houses might have looked like or been like in that period, if you have found this mikveh, which they've found no example of anywhere else in Jerusalem on other excavations, what else might you find as you keep going?
Actually, I should correct you. There is under the Old City, the Jewish Quarter, there are some basements of homes similar to ours, and one of them in particular has a mikveh and a bath.
Okay.
So it's, I guess you could say this is the second
but
one.
But you said.
And a few other ritual baths have
been. But you said they told you, the Israeli Antiquities Authority told you that there's nothing like this.
In general, yeah, I should qualify that. That this particular site, in terms of levels of preservation,
I see.
Appears to have more.
Now, all three of you are enthusiastic about this, but you know, you're a nursing student and not a religious studies student, or an archaeology student, and you're a religious studies student and on an archaeological dig. Would you have been just as enthusiastic? Would it have meant as much to you to go dig at Stonehenge or go to Rome and dig in the Forum as opposed to digging at a site that has religious connections, and not just Christian and Hebrew religious connections, but also Islamic religious connections? Would you have been just as excited at a secular dig?
Well, I personally, probably not as much, because I don't have any experience in archaeology, and mm-hmm. I'm not a religious studies major. This was more of a personal trip for me, and because of the connection that I had with the religion and the location of the dig, that's what made it really special for me. Now that I've done it, I might would go and do a different dig somewhere else because I've had the experience of doing it, and I know what to expect, and I know what it's like, but I had no idea what to expect going in and probably wouldn't have signed up for another location.
Kevin?
I would have enjoyed it just as much. There's something that's just so fun. There's something that's so energetic about this. But I'd say the special part about digging Zion is this is the genesis of my studies. I study Judeo-Christian origins. This is where I need to be in terms of my academic focus. This is the contextualization for my future academic career.
Then let me ask you this question. Because we've had a lot of people on here from the so-called Jesus Seminar. They are the people who are looking for the historical Jesus, not the... And they've gone through the Bible, the New Testament, line by line, and they've highlighted in different colors what Jesus absolutely said, what he might have said, and what he absolutely did not say. And I don't know how they arrive at those conclusions, but nonetheless they've done it. And they're looking, as are you, as a religious studies person, looking at the historical nature of Jesus and religion and not at the divine nature of Jesus or religion. As a person who went to Jerusalem because you have a connection to Christianity and an interest because of that, does it worry you, did it worry you, that you might find something or that something may be found down the road that may contradict some of the things that you believe?
Well, not particularly. It doesn't really worry me. I personally believe that everyone's allowed their own interpretation of what they read and what they believe. And if some historical evidence is found down the road that may change what I believe, I believe that, you know, I would take the time to look into it and decide if that was something that I'd choose to accept or if I'd choose to believe what I believe.
Because in your last book, the one that we talked about, Paul and Jesus, we have discovered that mm-hmm. much of what we think of as Christianity and the mm-hmm. teachings of Jesus are actually the teachings of Paul, the opinions of Paul.
Mm-hmm. I think I tell my students, look, we go with textual evidence, material evidence, archaeological evidence. Good evidence and good data is never the enemy of strong faith. And people can have their faith that goes beyond often the proving something into believing something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all recognize the difference between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. But I don't see those two as contradicting as much as intersecting. And I
know, Kevin, that you don't want to talk about your own personal religious beliefs, and that's fine. But I'm curious if your interest in being a religious studies major comes from a belief system or it comes from intellectual curiosity.
Well, my interest in religious studies is it is an academic field that examines the question of humanity. Religion, I think we could all agree, is an incredibly personal endeavor. It's an incredibly personal journey that people have gone through now for millennia. So religion represents what is important. Religion represents what is sacred. Religion represents what is not idealized, what is not good. So in investigating religion, you investigate what people find is important. You investigate the very innermost questions that we all ask ourselves. What is life? What is death? What is our purpose? What is good in the world? What is bad? And so in investigating religion, I investigate humanity. I get to, as someone who studies this field, continually play with questions, philosophical questions. I continually get to reflect on the nature of humankind. That's my interest in this field, and it's been incredibly rewarding.
So you took 22 students. There were 60 people on the dig. That means 40-some, 38-some people were not students. Who gets to go on these things?
The dig is open to anyone. Wasn't the oldest person was in his
78.
Really?
And, you know, we had two women from Myers Park Methodist, Amy Wynn and Linda Bierbauer, came from Jim Howell's church. Jim Howell himself is a great friend of our dig and a great supporter. So I invite, and we're digging again next summer, and if you go to digmountzion.uncc.edu.
digmountzion.uncc.edu. We'll put it up on our website.
You can keep up. We haven't put the information up yet for next year, but we would welcome volunteers. We like to call them participants. And we run a field school, as Kevin indicated. We are teaching. We're the only excavation in Jerusalem that is running a field school. As we're not just hiring laborers and clearing things out. We're down in the ditches showing people what they do. And so,
what's expected of you?
I'd like you to come, Mike.
What?
I would like you to come next summer, and I think we should do a special edition of Charlotte Talks from the Mount Zion Dig.
Now, how many hours do you dig? Let's get to the bottom.
We get up at 4:30.
What?
We leave at 5 our hotel. We arrive at the site by 5:45.
And what's the time difference?
Dig till noon.
Uh-huh.
And then you get part of the afternoon free, lectures in the evening, most evenings, touring on the weekends.
So I'm looking at maybe 5 hours of physical digging.
5 to 6 hours, yeah.
And what's the time difference?
Time difference is 7 hours.
So you
could work it out.
I'm just saying, 6 o'clock in the morning there is what, 1 o'clock in the afternoon here?
Yeah, we would figure out your 9 o'clock broadcast. We would probably do it
in the afternoon. In the morning.
No, we could do it in the – no, you do it in the afternoon.
In the afternoon.
Yeah.
I think we ought to do it. Would be an extended broadcast. It would be about 5 hours long. It would be during your – while you're digging, I'll be broadcasting.
Right. But just imagine how it would work. You would say, well, I'm seeing the sunrise over the Mount of Olives right now. I'm hearing the call to prayer, and I'm coming at you from the epicenter of Jerusalem. It already has a magical slogan to it.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize the Charlotte. We have the UNC Charlotte connection, but, you know, John Mackey told me to mention, the retiring CEO of Discovery Place, that this fall there will be this Jerusalem IMAX film, and it's going to be debuting there. And Charlotte, we hosted the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are a lot of people in Charlotte. You saw the Charlotte Observer story a few weeks ago about the women and men who took the trip from the temple and from the Baptist church.
Right.
We have a lot of Jerusalem connections here in Charlotte from all segments of the community. So I want this dig to be owned by the city as well as by the university.
that part of the world has changed hands so many times between Jews and Christians and Muslims and others, and all of that is encapsulated as you dig down through the layers of this and other sites over there. Does that help people understand who has or who does not have a right to lay claim to all of this?
I think it does, and we tell the students, what are we looking for? We're looking for everything that's there, and we really want to give place in our dig to everything that was there. As we're trying to show the confluence of civilizations, and our site is a good show and tell for that. That, I mean, you got the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of the tales of who and why people were there, but we want to tell it all.
The two of you are students. You're a senior. You'll be a senior this year. You'll be a junior this year. Where do you want this to go, and how does this experience fit into what you think will be the scheme of your life, Caroline?
Well, like I said before, it was a very personal experience, and I learned a great deal about, you know, myself and the city and the time that I spent there, and I would love to take back family and get to spend more time there because it is more of a personal experience for me to get to be there and experience it.
Kevin?
This represents the beginning of a future in this field. This represents the beginning of my academic career, so to speak. I will be back next year at Mount Zion, and I can't wait.
Hooked him in. We've got a recruit.
Wow. And what do you hope? You've uncovered a lot of interesting things over the year. What do you think is, and I only have 30 seconds, what's the most significant thing that you think you've discovered over the years?
That I've been involved in? Well, I clearly think it's the Taupiot tombs, the tombs that I think belong to the Jesus family would clearly be the most significant and the most controversial.
Absolutely. As we've talked about before, Dr. James Tabor, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte, author of The Jesus Dynasty, The Genus, Jesus Discovery, which is what we're talking about right
the
there, and Paul and Jesus, among other books. Kevin Caldwell, a religious studies student, and Caroline Brewer, a nursing student, both Levine scholars, both on the dig in Jerusalem. That we'll be broadcasting from next year.
That's
only we can raise the money. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.